just before we carry on, just to clarify for people, yeah, we have been recording the speakers for the last few weeks in this meeting. We do always ask our speakers if they're willing to be recorded, and at some stage, what we will do is edit the speakers out and then be able to put them up on the website because we realized that we were losing some great shares from some wonderful people. There is a notice to that effect up onto the website that this meeting is now being recorded, so I guess that's kind of where we're at. So thank you everybody who's read. And it's going to kind of fall to me to introduce our speaker tonight. And this is an individual I've known for several years now, mostly online, and I had the privilege of spending some face time with him a couple of years ago, and we have a kind of an empathy between us about various things in recovery and the kind of way things are. And he's a great guy. He has a chunk of recovery under his belt, and I respect his recovery, and I respect what he believes about our program. So I'm going to kind of just leave it at that, and introduce you to Patrick, who's from South Carolina. So Patrick is going to share for us for 40 or 45 minutes. So Pat, over to you, my friend. Thank you. Please share with us.
All right. Thank you, Steve. My name's Pat. I'm an addict.
Hi,
Pat.
Hi, Pat.
Right, well, I tell you what, I'm sitting here on my porch smoking a cigar, first smoking meeting I've been to in 10 years. It's kind of nice. No, there's nothing to be nervous about here. I can't even see. I don't even see the same screen that I seen yesterday. So I just, there's nothing. I see no icons. I don't know how many people's here. And all I can do is tell you about, you know, a little about what happened, how I got here, and what it's like now, what the journey's been like. And it's been a hell of a nice ride, I'll tell you. I'll just start off with little, you know, introduction. I'm, you know, I was born in 58 into a military family, November 4th, 1958, Clarksville, Tennessee. My father was stationed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And so I was born into a military family, a career military family. And we moved around a lot. And I know looking, you know, and working steps and looking back, it seems that some of these patterns of addiction started early in my life. We didn't live there very long, and we were moved back to Camden, South Carolina, which is where I currently reside. My mother and father were born in houses side by side, right beside each other. So I was moved back to the, you know, being right near my maternal and my paternal grandparents while my father took sea duty. And anyway, that's my first memories are, you know, being in Camden, and then we'd get stationed different places. In it, military life, you move around a lot. And I learned some things in military life that kind of was, I feel like, were the seeds of addiction. I learned when you move, you don't stay somewhere too long. And one of the things I learned is don't get close to people. It only hurts when you got to leave them. So I started distancing myself from close friends early on in my life. Also, the good part of that is I learned to be a social chameleon. When we'd move, you got to, you know, find new friends. So I learned how to easily adapt into situations and circumstances and quickly blend in. It also kind of taught me to peep and play, sit back and observe and watch, you know, watch things unfold. Kind of look at your angles. Anyway, I'm going to start a timer here so I don't get too long-winded. Don't want to stay stuck into much of this. But anyway, one of our assignments was in Norfolk, Virginia. And I was taught by the men in my family that you never start a fight, but you never walk away from one either. And I was in the, they did not have kindergarten in the United States back then. So you started straight into first grade. And back then, the teachers smoked in school. They'd have a, you know, a little break in the middle of the morning. The teachers would step into the hallway and smoke a cigarette, and they'd give the kids some kind of afternoon snack, and they'd give us some milk, a carton of milk, and some cookies. And one of the kids in the class, he always got these bigger, overgrown kids, was a, which we'd call a bully now. This kid come up, and he drank his milk real quick. Teacher was out there smoking a cigarette in the hall, peeping back through this little narrow window. And he come over to my desk and grabbed my carton of milk off the desk. And I objected, and I tried to get out of my seat, and he pushed me back into my seat. I objected, tried to get up, and he pushed me back down. And I looked down, and I saw this big, fat pencil. We used to have to practice handwriting back then. And I grabbed that pencil, and I stabbed this kid in the face, neck. I probably stabbed him half a dozen times before the teacher come back in. All the kids were screaming. She hauled me off by my ear down to the principal's office. Principal asked me why I did it. I told her, you know, he took my milk. And she told me that was not a good reason for stabbing this kid the way I did. And I said, look, you just don't understand. And she definitely didn't understand. So I, you know, when they say cuss like a sailor, I'd learned a few choice words around the neighborhood. I called her the B word and promptly got drugged by my ear to the bathroom, which point she put a bar of soap in my mouth. And when she put the soap in my mouth, I really did start a string of cursing then. And they had this powdered Baraxo hand soap back then. And she reached to the dispenser and got as much of it as she could hold in the palm of her hand while holding me by the hair of the head and shoved it down my throat. And needless to say, I was suspended and sent to some psychiatrist. And this was the end of my public school career for the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia. My father had to pay to get me into a private school, and they weren't too crazy about taking me either. He was on a seaman's pay, so it wasn't very much. Well, it wasn't long after that we got an assignment to California. And we moved to the Imperial Beach, San Diego area. We finally got some base housing out on the, what they call the Silver Strand. It was a little man-made peninsula leading to the island of Coronado. And it was there, I guess they looked over my record and started off in a classroom, but I was quickly assimilated into a special type of classroom, like a Montessori type classroom. There were me and two other kids in there, and we were allowed to basically study anything we wanted to study. Whatever our coordinate, whatever we wanted to study, they brought us books, microscopes, or anything that we wanted. And we were isolated. We were the big windows, big, very big windows in the school. And we'd look out at other kids, and we weren't even allowed to go out to recess with them. We had our own special recess. And so this, I call this like a cauldron of isolation. I didn't know what I had particularly done, but it didn't, you know, it didn't really bother me. But I just kind of accepted it. It was pretty cool. We got to study what we wanted to study. And they had year-round school there. You could take summer school. Next thing we would know, we were getting some orders to San Francisco. And we were staying over in Oakland, Alameda. And it was a lot rougher school district in Oakland. So I was allowed to join the other kids. Anyway, this is about the time that I became really curious about drugs. This is summer 69. And a friend of mine, his sister was running around with some, I guess, more be like a gang. We got her to pour some weed, and we decided we'd get together and smoke it at school. So we went in and we had had a number rolled up, and we went and smoked some weed and got caught by the janitor. And he like took the stuff from us, and he didn't say anything. He went and flushed it down the toilet. And this was late 69, 70. Later that year, my father retired. We moved back to South Carolina. Well, it did not take me long to find the people here, and they just graduated really, really quick from, finding the people that knew where the weed was at. Barbiturates. I was reunited with cousins that were doing it, and so wasn't long I was introduced to IV drugs, and the trouble has started. Started getting in trouble. All the trouble was directly related to drugs. I ended up going to some reformatories. I had given a friend of mine a large batch of barbiturates to sell, and he ended up taking more of them, and he ended up dying. His sister saw me give them to him, and I got sentenced to a state facility at the age of 16. I was 21 or otherwise released by the state, and this is after three or four trips into juvenile reformatories. And this is where I first got introduced into, I guess you'd say, drug rehabilitation, treatment center type stuff. This is around 1975. I'd been in there for about 2 years, and I kept missing the parole dates. What I did not understand were the nuances of South Carolina law, that if a sheriff of a county did not want you in his county, he could request that you not be returned to his county. And I was wanting to come back here, and they didn't want me back here. Community sentiment was pretty high that I was they would not want me back into the county anymore. So I had a parole officer that would vouch for me in front of the board. I'd missed three boards. The board didn't happen, but every 6 months you'd keep coming up for a parole. And he wanted me to go to a drug treatment center. And I insisted I did not have a drug problem. And after the third time I missed that board, I decided that anything was better than sitting in there. And I told him that I would be willing. Only problem was I was still a juvenile, and this program was designed for Vietnam veterans coming back strung out on heroin. And he told me he could get me an interview, but I better shine. And so he lined me up an interview several months down the road, and I went in and I put it in charge. And I ended up getting in this first juvenile in the state to get in this one drug facility. And it was there that I met David Moorhead of Baby Blue fame. David Moorhead was right across the hall from me. And David was traveling through. He was coming back from California. And we were not roomies, but housemates for about a year. Interesting things, when I finally made it into the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous, five or six people from that program had already made it into the rooms. One of the guys that I paved the way for I saw him in the early part of 1988, and I asked him. I saw him in the Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I asked him. I says, if he remembered me, and he said he did. He called me by my name, and I was really proud of my 6 months or whatever I had. And I asked him. I said, "Well, Eddie, this thing works. How long do you have now?" He said, "Well," he said, "if I make it to October, I'll have 10 years clean." And I was like, "Wow." I could not imagine that. He had left, went back and did one stint in the county jail, and you know, came in and got clean in Narcotics Anonymous. So I saw proof that the program worked. Anyway, all drugs ever did for me was lead me to a lot of jails and institutions and cry out centers and a whole lot of degradation. That was my initial introduction, was in the mid-70s. In between the mid-70s and when I got clean. I got clean February 4th, 1988. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. I got introduced to the program when all they had was a little white book. And they put the numbers on the back of it, and they told me it was a hip pocket program. The group in Camden that I was introduced to started somewhere around 1980, 1981. I had a cousin who was trying to get clean, and everybody in the neighborhood seemed to want to drag him down, and I decided I'd support him. And he asked me if I would go to some meetings with him. So that's what I did. I had no intention of getting clean, but what I heard was I heard my story. I immediately became suspicious. I thought he had told them about me before we got there. And it scared me. I knew 5 of the 7 people that were in the group. I had used with them, but I was not beaten yet. I could fully see his problem. I just couldn't see my own. So it took me a couple of more treatment centers, 3 or 4 more times in detox. And really getting drug. I mean, I was drug really hard. The last 5 years, I was unemployable. I did nothing but the getting and using and finding ways and get means to get more. That was my life. And my world shrunk. Basically 5 or 6 square blocks around the house I was staying in. House I was staying in, I had no electricity, I had no water. I turned the water back on so many times they'd come in, they took the water meter. I used candles. I went and got water from a neighbor's house. I was very fortunate in the fact that this Narcotics Anonymous group that was formed here in Camden was flourishing. When I came in, there were 6 members in the home group that had more than 5 years clean. And that was pretty amazing. When Camden group got put on the regional meeting schedule, there were 6 groups in both the Carolinas, which is pretty large geographical area. And a meeting list would take about a half of a legal sized piece of paper, double spaced, for all the meetings in both the Carolinas. So I was blessed to have a whole lot of recovery right in my own backyard, maybe about 2 miles from the house. We had 2 meetings a week. We had an Alcoholics Anonymous group that met in the same clubhouse that met 21 times a week. So it was kind of pretty normal then for people to supplement their program with going to Alcoholics Anonymous between times. I saw very early on that it was not for me. I felt like I was trying to be fit into a mold there that I could not possibly fit into. There was a certain unspoken code of conduct and behavior that I could not, I don't believe, conform to, if that makes sense. despite feeling some social pressures to do so. I felt like it was very dishonest. So it roughly, about a year clean, I made the decision that I would not participate in any more Alcoholics Anonymous. We were trying to expand our meetings. It was starting to grow in this area geographically. Were meetings in Columbia, and there were meetings in Hartford. All these places I mentioned are about 30 miles from me. So I would get in the car, and I would drive. I would drive 7 nights a week. I became totally immersed in the Narcotics Anonymous program. I followed the suggestions. I was willing to follow suggestions. I got a sponsor. I started applying, working steps. I did everything I was supposed to do, even some of the treatment center suggestions, like no relationships for the first year. I just know my people would say stuff like that, and I was like, well, I really don't have anything or anything to offer anybody anyway. And I guess I think the only thing I really wanted was I wanted to just be clean. I wanted to have my own mind back. I didn't want the drugs telling me what I was going to do, when I was going to do it, and where I was going to do it. I wanted to make some decisions in my life without the drugs dictating the decisions. So I totally immersed myself in the program. I started doing little small amounts of service in the home group. Back then, all the meetings were smoking. And they had ashtrays and they had coffee cups. And they would tell me, said, hey, come over here and empty the ashtrays. Go wash the ashtrays. I was like, nah, screw you. I'm going out the sidewalk and smoke a cigarette. I thought they were trying to punk me out because I was the new man in the group. And I'd go smoke a cigarette and go back inside. The ashtrays would still be waiting on me. So I started doing a little bit there. You know, helping them sweep up, clean up the ashtrays, wash coffee cups. And one of the older members started saying, hey, I got somewhere I want you to go with me Sunday. And they started dragging me to area meetings. So I started going to these meetings, and it didn't take me but about 2 or 3 meetings. And I said, well, why are you dragging me to these meetings? He said, you fool, you're going to be our new GSR. He said, I've been doing this for 2 years. I'm tired of it. So... by default, I was getting trained to be a GSR, and at that time, I was starting to enjoy my service work. I was getting out to area meetings, floated between various towns, so I was meeting some new people, getting to know them a little bit better, and then that way, when I rode down to their cities or their Narcotics Anonymous meetings, I already knew some people there, so I felt comfortable. This quickly became a descent. You know, we have a reverse pyramid, and I started descending down the service structure quickly. I think mainly because I was willing to do the work. A lot of people like the title, but they did not really like to do the work. They just like to show up and have a title, and I would do the work. So I quickly became a ASR, quickly found myself in region. I had a girl that was sitting on the board of trustees for the World Service Office, asked me if I would take a nomination to be the chairperson of Carolina Region. And this was 1989, and I told her I didn't have the clean time, and she said, well, I don't care. She said, this is my swan song. I've been clean 14 years. I've got 30 years of service resume behind me, and I'm going to be leaving this thing, and I want to know that I'm leaving it in good hands. You're passionate. You seem to love Narcotics Anonymous, and I think people would vote you in despite your lack of clean time. And I said, well, if you think so, I'll throw my name in the hat. And I did, and to my chagrin, I got elected to be the vice chair, and the next year I was the chair. And this was at the time that the baby blue controversies came out, and suing, members suing members. Carolina region, we had a fair amount of people that were sitting on world seats or world committees. We had to, as I said, she was on the doing the interim term on the board of trustees. We had one girl sitting on the board of directors that eventually signed the FIPT agreements, and just a lot of connection to the world level politics. And it was there that something really, I think, really, really important happened in my recovery. I had a guy who was later to be on the World Board of Directors. I had a vice chair, and he would have been taking blue books, baby blues, into H&I meetings across North Carolina. And they wanted me to throw him under the bus and have a Spanish Inquisition at the regional meeting. And I refused to. I had control of the meeting in the aspect that if you didn't get to speak on the floor of the Carolina region unless you were elected by the groups. We had no delegated responsibility at this time. You were speaking for the groups or you wasn't speaking. And I had a guy come up and whisper in my ear. He said, you're getting ready to throw away a perfectly good service career. And I laughed and I looked at him and it was jaw dropping. I said, this is not a career. I do this as the way I give back to Narcotics Anonymous. I love Narcotics Anonymous. And things, the politics got really ugly. I made a decision at that point that when my term was up, I would go back to the home group. And what I would do is make the newer member feel welcome and make him feel welcome long enough that he could claim his seat. That became my central philosophy, is that the greatest service that I can do Narcotics Anonymous is to make the newcomer feel at ease and to feel welcome. And that is where I believe I do my best work. I will never be a speaker. I never desire to be an NA politician. I don't have any desires other than to be just a good home group member and a good member of Narcotics Anonymous to help people when they reach out, when they reach out or they got a question, to share my experience, strength, and hope with them. So I developed a pivotal philosophy at that time that there is no higher service than to just be a home group member. That is it. That's all I aspire. I've had two sponsors in the course of my 31 years of recovery. One of them taught me a great deal about the steps. The other one, I chose him at about 12, 13 years clean because he had a very good working knowledge of the traditions. I believe in sponsorship. I believe in the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. I just believe in living the principles. And I believe that powerless people act powerless. I just, I've developed some philosophies along the way that tend to line up more with the older members in the fellowship from the 50s and the 60s about steps. I believe we can practice a principle. I believe we can follow a principle. I believe we can take the appropriate actions. I don't really believe that we can sit down and do a homework assignment and do any more than just gain a basic understanding of the step or the tradition. It's all about our application. And that's what I try to do, is just apply the steps into my life. Every day, you know, it's just repetition, repetition. To embrace this way of life and to try to live it to the best of my ability. And that's what I do. Still got tons of character defects. I got every single one of them. Most days I have a lot of freedom. Try not to do any harm. Try to be very proactive in my moral and ethical code. I don't know, it's fairly, to me, it's just a basically a very simple program. It revolves around some very, you know, basic true supremacists. You know, if I don't use, I go to meetings, I apply and follow the principles in my life to the best of my ability. And then share this with other people, how I'm working and applying these principles. And I benefit from it. The people around me benefit from it. I'm kind of getting stymied here. Don't know much more to say. I had my sponsor recently passed. He had moved out from Connecticut to San Diego in 69 to be closer to the program and work at the VA out there. His name was Don Anderson. And Don told me, said, Pat, he said, you can sum this program up in 6 words. He said, trust God, clean house, and help others. And if I keep the program as simple as that, I really can't go wrong. As long as I've got that don't use on top of it, and I follow that little mantra, then I'm in pretty good shape. Anyway, I don't know if anybody got anything out of that. All I can say is I'm kind of getting lost in my own dust. I'm still a little ADD. My mother used to say I was like a fart in a whirlwind. So here I am off talking in the thin air, looking out at squirrels playing a big oak tree in the yard, and just enjoying a beautiful Saturday here in South Carolina. I hope everybody out there in internet land is loving their Saturday as much as I'm loving mine. Anyway, I'd like to thank Steve for allowing me to share and take up y'all's time this Saturday. So thank you very much. God bless you all.